I can think of a few in my life. So I've got these points now. I imagine those who are listening may also be reflecting key instances of a transformative nature, be they, like you said, painful or inspirational. So I think what I'm drawn to then is the updating or rewriting. It's like the reinterpretation that becomes available with perspective and hindsight and additional life experience in service to unfolding the universal potential of human life. That's a major theme for me right now and for many others as well.
Throughout history, the great questions have been asked, and great research has been undertaken, always expanding the territory of the known by shining a light into the unknown. Where is that cutting edge today? And can a community of people from all over the world, each carrying their own unique journey of discovery, come together to inquire at the edge of purposeful evolution through conversation? At Portals of Perception, we think it is possible, and we hope that you will choose to be a part of this exploration.
In this conversation, we take a deeper look at the experience of searing moments, the profoundly meaningful moments, positive or perhaps traumatic and painful, that may be influencing our behavior and attitudes and how we engage with life. Even with searing moments from early in life, we can decide and choose how we think about and write the experience into ourselves. We call it the practice of searing moments, continually unfolding their meaning to a point where we rewrite and update their significance. Join Aviv Shahar and Jeff Vanderkloot for Searing Moments and Their Transformational Power.
Welcome to Portals of Perception. I'm here with Jeff, and we are ready to skate to the frontiers of emergence, our own and the collective emergence, and discover what is emerging with us today. So what is alive for you today, Jeff? Where should we explore and skate to today?
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Aviv, as always. I'm so grateful to be part of the Portals of Perception. And I am happy also to share that I'm in Crestone, Colorado, which is a wonderful place. The land is very powerful, very sacred. It's in a valley that has been called the Bloodless Valley because there was never fighting here. And there are many spiritual centers now in Crestone. So all kinds of lineages and traditions and backgrounds are represented. So there's a real richness as well as a great clarity at this altitude. The valley is at 8,000 feet and it goes up from there. So yeah, I feel like I'm in a fresh place with a lot of fresh energy and perspectives for today. And in terms of what's emerging for me, I suppose it's worth not holding back. So let me just say that last week and since Passover, Easter, there has been a real renewal and also a renewal of my sense of the possible and my knowing that heaven on earth, the promised land, is here now. And I really feel it viscerally. I have no more doubt. The signal strength is not evenly distributed. So there's plenty of work to do. But I'm seeing also that the people I work with, the people I know and relate with, are seemingly slipping across this threshold into heaven on earth. Somehow, more and more people, not everyone yet, but many people are experiencing this profound peace and settling into, let's say, true nature and the present moment without worry for the future or carrying the past into the present moment. So there's some kind of release, some kind of deep healing and liberation that I feel is very much present for the collective. And so, yeah, I look forward to skating around this and other topics with you today.
So when you say heaven on earth, you're describing an unfolding process, not a moment in time. Am I getting that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a time-based place or phenomenon. It's maybe a state of consciousness, you could say. It's characterized by a profound feeling of peace and trust, relaxation, and also knowing of what the moment calls for, and then being able to act upon that. So one could say right action, arising from the rootedness in the present moment. And then empirically, I've discovered, and I know it's not just me, that one right action leads to another right action, leads to beautiful things, large systems, even complex systems emerging that actually work. So I believe that's what's happening for our society now, is this wholesale reinvention and transformation from the inside out, which will result in new institutions and different economic models that are premised on different ideas.
Yeah, very curious. And you sense that on Thursday, the following the Passover and Easter, well, Passover was this year earlier, but Easter weekend, we actually worked on both weekends. So this weekend, we just yesterday landed a 3-day epoch culmination discovery journey, deepening in the green and blue epoch and the function and the purpose. And once again, when I say green and blue, many people will have different associations for the colors from variety of frameworks and development frameworks, where colors are mostly used as signifiers of stages of development and such. I mean, and use the colors in quite a different context, more as actual realms of potential in the way they reveal themselves through the human experience, and what these therefore release as a function, where the fractal of those permissions continues to reemerge throughout the epoch. So that's a body of work we focused on over the last 3 days and expanded into the fields of research and the body of work that needs to be taken up. And it clearly requires hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people worldwide to attend to all these, because we are, the gist of it, we are, if we embrace the framing that you offered of an heaven on earth, which would coincide very beautifully with the idea of a fractal of a green epoch release, because one of the functions, one of the teleologies of a green fractal is to forever renew the epoch when we reach a point of an end of something, or when something gets to an exhaustion point and it needs now to find its next new point of renewal and release. And so that's what we've done in this last weekend. The weekend before, we spent a long Saturday, 7-hour, exploring the practice and the technology of searing moments, and the practice and the function of searing moments, and the philosophical, theological, and metaphysical, if you like, dimensions of it. So we can go to, we can skate to any of the above. I have a sense of how it may want to play out, but you always have an intuitive sense. So let me ask you, should we explore any of the above or go somewhere else? Please lead us where it feels on to go to.
Well, for whatever reason, I feel searing moments very strongly. Maybe that's a starting point, that maybe we'll burn something away and something will be revealed. I'm definitely curious.
Okay, great. So let's do searing moments and then see if there is a natural way to flow to attend to what we just touched on in the idea of a green and blue epoch. Well, so let me say, I'm still learning how to actually talk about this idea of a searing moment. Although I have been doing or practicing the idea of a searing moment maybe for 30 years, maybe longer, before I actually knew I was doing something that I will later discover could be called a searing moment practice. This is one of those situations where the practice and the discovery is ongoing as an internal practice before you actually know you're doing something. Then when you reach a point sometime 5 years later, in this case, more of a 28 years later, and you say, okay, how can I share or teach or communicate the way of the practice? And then you discover that you need to translate some of what you're doing into language. And when you do, you become, of course, more informed in yourself about it, because what was semi or unconscious becomes conscious, which is the gift of teaching or sharing or coaching to others. Because whenever we teach or coach to others, we first of all teach to ourselves, because we understand what the bleep we're actually doing. So I'd say that I'm discovering, and let's see through this rendering now how it will appear. The second thing I'll say is that, so there is a way to talk about the practice of searing moments. And when we talk about the practice, we will be looking at the what is it you can do and why and how do you take profoundly meaningful moments that occurred along your journey, either early in your life or later that were they were more self-fashioned, self-authored and created. And you actually decided to make something a searing moment in the way you have chosen to write it into yourself. So a variety of searing moments, and I can give example. And then when we talk about the practice, it's the idea that you can continue to unfold the significance and develop the meaning of something that occurred to a point that you actually rewrite or update the significance of something. So that would be the practice. That's one level. I'm offering a simple threefold loom, how to explore searing moments. The second would be more the philosophical and theological inquiry, which is why is it important now, especially in this time when we're going to use a different or adjacent language, not different, but adjacent language to what you offered, when we can tell a story theologically and philosophically, and if you choose to embrace it as actual, you can as well, that we humans are now in the early stages of graduating to a new next phase of evolution in which we are summoned or called or activated into the idea of homo universalis to begin to unfold and release the universal potential of human life and what that means and why central to that development is the idea of becoming a self-authored human, which will link us to the green epoch because the catalyst, the green catalyst in the way it is appearing now as a fractal is an activation and release of the self-authored potential. So a bit of a tie-up. You know that I often think in a loom fashion, so I'm integrating those on the front end. So that would be the philosophical, theological line as we explore searing moments. The third would be more the invisible or metaphysical dimension, which in some way is a bridge between the practice and the theology. And when we will unfold and try to talk about searing moment in that context, in that dimension, we're describing moments in our lives where by luck or judgment or by serendipity or because of conscious interior intervention, we either allow or were or found ourselves in a moment in time where the realms of potential infiltrate the manifest realm. And what that means and how the searing moment technology and practice is a way to unfold and release the furtherance of what's locked in that searing moment such that it becomes a source that continues to inform and reveal and offer revelatory content along your journey. So in actuality, you are not talking about something that happened in the past because this is where the theological, philosophical, metaphysical come together. You'd say the moment that you have lived in back in time became a searing moment because for one reason or another, there was some property, some content, painful or inspirational, transformational or arresting. All of the above could be searing moments where there was some content that wrote itself, engraved itself, etched itself, seared itself to every cell in your body such that it becomes an imprint on your soul. Hence, I'm calling the idea that practice a searing moment and the idea that you can, in your meditative, contemplative practice, access that experience, access that energetic content, and actually unfold and change or update the script of it in yourself. So I gave you the menu without going yet to the full depth, but simply to frame the practice of a searing moment, the theological and the metaphysical, and perhaps the best way is to talk about them all at the same time. But let me just pause here and give you a chance to react and guide the conversation how it makes sense to further unfold this.
I feel somewhat activated by the possibility of exploring searing moments in a more way. I can think of a few in my life, so I've got these points now. I imagine those who are listening may also be reflecting key instances of a transformative nature, be they, like you said, painful or inspirational. So I think what I'm drawn to then is the updating or rewriting. It's like the reinterpretation that becomes available with perspective and hindsight and additional life experience in service to unfolding the universal potential of human life. That's a major theme for me right now and for many others as well. So it does seem like we're on the cusp of something there. I'd love to have an additional tool in the toolkit to the work of
becoming Homo Universalis.
Yeah, great. That's the project we are in, yes?
Yes.
So I'm going to offer a few examples of searing moments to concretize and instantiate the practice. Before I do, let me offer a two-layered metaphor, because which is something I've actually used in a little writing that we worked with when we explored into and sensed into the potential of searing moments. And so we're going to be revealing our age through the metaphor, because I'm going to talk about photography prior to digital cameras. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity, I certainly did have earlier in my life as a hobby, to step into the dark room, to develop the film, to then use that projection imprint machine, and then put the paper in that a bucket with chemical fluids. And in that dark room, you see inside the bucket with chemical fluids, the figure begins to emerge on the paper. And I use this metaphor to propose the potential of searing moment, that in a searing moment, we use a similar technology. The dark room in this case is the inner, interior contemplative chamber, chamber of discovery of the meaning of your experience and what you choose to ascribe to it, and your capacity to stay with something that happened, such that in this case, not the chemicals, but the alchemical content of your soul and spirit compound and how they develop the content of your experience, they reveal a latent potential that perhaps was never revealed. So here is an example, okay? And then I'll come to the second layer of the metaphor. So this goes back to perhaps around age 8. Our family doctor tells my father that we need to go and see the heart specialist. And we travel to a hospital in Tel Aviv to visit with the heart specialist, and we enter on this winter morning those murky green corridors and wait there and then enter the room, and I'm being told to take off my shirt because I'm going to have all these things, stickers on my chest, and I'm already shaking. First, I'm shaking because it's cold, and secondly, I'm shaking because I'm frightened that something is wrong with me. We are discovering after the test, when we go back into the room, and I'm speaking about it in the present tense because that's part of the idea of a searing moment, that the doctor has a concern, but he is not even looking at my eyes, not looking at me, he's looking at my father, and he's saying, your son has a mild condition and you need to watch over him. And in my mind, in my child mind, in my child eye, there is something gravely wrong with me, and I get frightened. And we catch the bus ride back to the kibbutz where we live. And there is this moment when it rains outside and I feel like everything is raining in me. And a moment, okay, that's a searing moment that is coupled to the searing moment with the doctor, because what is arising in me is the spirit of defiance. And I turn around to my father and I say, you know, this is not going to be. I'm going to run free. In Hebrew, of course. So I don't know that it rhymed. But I was defiant that the message from the doctor was not going to shape my destiny. Within months, I started to pick long-distance running. And 3-4 years later, I became the Israeli champion for long distance running for my age group at 12 and 13. And we went to see the doctor, that same doctor, a couple of years later, and the condition that was there disappeared. Unbeknown to me, I didn't know at the time that that defiant spirit unleashed, unlocked a healing process. So that was a searing moment that was locked in my childhood. But when I brought the updating content of that later, I sourced in it the spirit of defiance. That was something that I was able to unfold into the moment, such that I now know that there is a capacity in me to transfer to others the courage, the bravery to overcome frightening messages and scary moments, to melt, to thaw these experiences. Because what happens is scary moments, they tend to freeze us in time. The idea of a searing moment is to release that potential. And once you release the potential, you actually unpack and unlock a tremendous healing permission in your own process, in your own experience. So now I'll put a second layer on the development of the black and white film in the dark room, because now add to it the technology that appears later with digitized photography, where you now have actually the capacity, the permission to bring and add and change colors on the picture. And I propose that the fact that we have that technological evolution is simply an indication of that permission being released at a higher, this is the metaphysical view, if you like, the technology is a technological expression of a permission granted to the human mind, to the human spirit, in that we are given a self-authoring capacity. And I know that I'd be the first to admit that there is a below-the-line usage and application of that technology in the fake news, deep fake of people being able to create completely fake videos. Every new technology has a below-the-line, undesired, dysfunctional, potentially depressing and degenerative application, but also a higher permission. In the metaphor I use here, think of the technology of adding and changing and composing colors as the permission we have to take something that happened and unlock in it greater significance. So I've come to a second moment. This happens when I'm a young pilot in the Air Force, the Israeli Air Force, and the Air Force is playing War Games Day, and I'm discovering that even though I'm very young, I'm scheduled in the formation of my wing unit to fly in the formation that will represent our wing. And we go through the brief, and then an hour and a half later, there is a wire that comes down that there was an accident. And we quickly find out that somebody crashed. And we quickly find out which unit it was and who it was. And I quickly come to realize that this was my chief instructor, an earlier phase as I was just graduating in a fighter pilot course. And I feel like a sharp knife has just gone straight into my stomach, like all the air is taken out of me. And I'm physically shaken. But the Air Force has a bit of a bravado culture, at least back then. I think it has evolved since then. You're not supposed to, back then, show that degree of vulnerability. So I find a hidden moment. I literally, physically throw up, because that's what that piece of news caused in me. But the show must go on. I'm a young man and I have to play the macho game. So I didn't want to go to the cockpit that day. A machine I learned to admire and love just betrayed somebody I admired who was definitely 100 times a better pilot than me. What are the chances that I will come back alive from this next flight? So I suppressed the feeling for many, many years until I started to engage more consciously with the practice of searing moments. And I traveled back to that moment and I changed the end of the story, not the end of his crush. But I've now shared this story and the teachable moral of the story, because when I tell the story and I share this with executive teams and groups all around the world for the last 15, 20 years. And as a way of bringing them into what in the corporate arena I've been calling for years, centering moments, which has the idea of searing moments, just in the way the searing moments technology evolved recently, it has taken greater depth that we are now exploring. And when I share the story, I communicate the teaching that he transferred to me by once failing to follow his own brief, because he used to always, in the briefing room, say the following: stay within the comfort zone of the practice envelope. You don't need to fly lower. You don't need to push outside the practice envelope. And he got competitive for a moment and failed to follow his own brief, failed to practice what he preached. And it cost him everything. Young, beautiful life, lost like this. And I share, when I share the story, that I tell it to remind myself, because we fail every day. We're never perfect. We fall on our face and we pick ourselves up. But I try very hard, if I can, to walk my talk, practice what I preach to the best of my ability, never perfect. Because if you don't, it will, in a bad case, will cost you your reputation. In the worst case, it'll cost you your life. And now I'll bring you to a third searing moment. I am sitting in a room with 12 other people and an inspirational teacher. And there is a lot that is unfolding and opening with great transformational teaching. And I carry maybe 100, maybe 200 searing moments from inspirational, transformational moments of teaching coming alive. Here is one of them, because in that situation with 12 people in the room, there is a moment when the teacher explains that the human has a capacity to bring to life any feeling, any sentiment, any energy, any presence you can imagine in the entire universe inside your space, inside your energy field. You have that complete freedom. It's part of the self-authored freedom. What will you give credence to? What will you give permission to in your life such that that becomes your signature? And he says the following. He says, I decided that I will not make space in my life for bitterness. Sure, I'm a human being. There will be moments that I will feel bitter where something happens that is disappointing, and it's natural for a human to experience. But I will not allow that energy, decided, he said, when I was a young man, that I didn't want to allow that energy to occupy my space. Because I realized that if I would make my space, my energy space, and my life an ecology for bitterness, then nothing fine, nothing sweet, nothing very high and pristine will find that space to be attractive. And it matters not what happened in the next 5 or 6 hours of that conversation and that workshop and what happened the following day. I mean, it matters very much. But for all intents and purposes, for me, that was a moment that was sufficient for the price of admission. Because there was a brief, a practical brief for my entire life. And I remember 16 years after that moment, so that tells you the perspective, the time, I am traveling the Pacific Northwest. I'm looking to find different retreat centers and places to hold retreats. And I come upon a place, a bed and breakfast, and I get to talk to the owner of the place. And she tells me about the vision of the place and how she gave rise to it and what was the vision of what it will become. And then she goes into a story that narrates the tremendous pain and bitterness of her partner, her husband, that left her in the middle of the vision. And it feels to me as she speaks about it as though it happened 2 weeks ago or maybe 9 months ago, maybe 18 months ago. And she continues the story, and when she ends the story, she reveals that it happened 32 years ago. And when she ended the story and we drove away from that place, I thought, wow, she stayed with that frozen moment for 32 years. She has all the justification, the pain and the disappointment and all that, but she did not unfold the potential of what occurred to a whole new level. She did not develop, evolve that searing moment to a new script. to a new significance. And the teaching that I carried from that idea of never allow bitterness to preoccupy you and condition the totality of who you are, because so much is lost when you allow for that to happen, became active in me inside the interaction with her. So these are three, four examples, and a little bit about the practice of the searing moment. I'd say in addition that the practice is literally allowing yourself to enter the contemplative space. And now I'll actually bring into it that more invisible metaphysical dimension, which is, so imagine that there are always two movies going on. There is the visible, the manifest realm, the movie of the manifest realm, and there is the invisible movie that is actually, so if the manifest realm is a movie that's 3D, three dimension, I don't know what the invisible movie, maybe it's a 6D, maybe it's a 9D, maybe it's a 12 or 14 or 16 or 21 dimensions. So if we can talk about the manifest realm as a hologramic unfolding movie, I don't know what the language will be to describe the multidimensional nature of the realms of potential. What I'm proposing is that, so something happens in the manifest realm, and from the realms of potential, one permission or one script infiltrated that moment. But you can actually, in your contemplative life, choose to source the realm of potential, and you can say, okay, well, that's one way that story unfolds. I can actually source another story, and a second, and a third, and a fourth story, or I can take that one story and I can unfold it to the next chapter, and the next chapter, and the one after that, where sometime a moment of transformative message or teaching really only reveals its fuller potential 7 or 9 or 12, or in my case, because I'm slow in process, 28 years later, where the chastity of the practice is that you allow the moment that occurred to regain its originating, sourcing permission in yourself. So you're not bound by the limitation of how somebody else would tell the story. Now, somebody may say, this is just a large psychobabble. Somebody else say, nice, you've just shared with us a whole new shadow work technology. Fair enough. All of those would be true. I'm saying there is something much more potential here in the context of the self-authoring significance of human life and how we are called to discover the next phase of evolution. This was a lot longer than what I imagined, but I'm going to pause here.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Aviv, for not holding back either. I appreciate the fullness of the sharing and the explanations. And I feel that I need the fullness in order to be able to respond in a full way. And then what just came to me a couple of minutes ago was an appreciation of an example that's very alive in my life today. That is an example of a steering moment and the reauthoring process. So I've been doing it too. I didn't have the vocabulary or the clarity around how this might be a general tool that can be applied. A whole new modality of shadow work, you could say, you have said. So my parents left this plane of existence in 2000 and 2003. And I remember somebody who said to me, oh, you're an orphan now. And I didn't feel that way at all. It's interesting because when my father passed, there was a feeling of lightness and liberation. And I had a certain story at the time that it was maybe not the necessary way, but a way for liberating certain family dynamics, in particular in relation to my brother. I could see how he was being released from a kind of story that just went round and round and never seemed to change, where he was the victim. And these stories, I suppose, are quite common. Well, this morning, I was reflecting because the husband of a friend just passed away. And a lot of people have been leaving this plane recently, I've noticed. And it's not even mostly COVID in my experience. In fact, COVID has hardly been in my field. It's been quite distant. But yeah, so it had me reflecting again on the losses that I have experienced personally. And I was thinking back to my father's passing and my mother's passing, which was a bit more dramatic and traumatic. She'd had a surgery and then there was a complication and suddenly she was gone. quite unexpectedly. I realized this morning that yes, liberation was involved in both cases. It cleared the way for me to be me. It allowed me, frankly, abruptly encouraged me to let go of the stories and the baggage that I might have been carrying. Not just my brother. I mean, that could be an externalization of something in me as well. And I just have to say, I really appreciate the gift. This is one narrative, right, that has been sourced. There could be others, and other people may have very different perspectives. But I feel a great truth in the generosity of my parents in leaving the world so that I could flower. And I am fairly certain it would not have been possible for me to be where I am now. I'd be somewhere, and maybe it'd be great too, if the family energies had stayed in place the way they were and evolved in a kind of more or less linear way. I mean, there might have been nonlinear healing and miraculous awakenings, though that hasn't happened so much in their generation. So I don't think that's likely. I really feel that I was set free. And although there was pain, of course, something in me knew that it was liberating, but didn't have clarity around that. So it was like I kept it to myself. And now I would still be mindful about sharing this perspective, because others who really felt the pain of those losses would perhaps not appreciate it. But I have this knowing, and it's a liberation also to share that with you. And I do feel the reauthoring power of the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you started telling the story, I smiled. And the reason I smiled was because I felt the expansion, energetic expansion that was in the essence of the story. That was for you a release. Now, we could go deep now into what occurs in that moment and talk about the mechanics of grief and which we won't. I don't think that's what we want to go into now. But in the simplicity of the story that you offered and its profundity at the same time, I do believe there are the two dimensions. There is the release of what you call family dynamics and constellations that were arrested or frozen in time, and the release of that and a letting go, and also a whole new permission that opens up. So there is always the, what is it we are able to move away from, and what is it that we may be able to begin to move towards in the way you tell the story and in the exampleship of your life of how you practically took that moment in time and decided to spread your wings. Not just metaphorically, but probably physically in every sense of it, in the way you've chosen to live your life. And the beauty of how you tell the story in the reauthoring of it is that you embrace the last interaction with them around the essence of generosity and love of letting go. The love and the generosity of letting go and of release. So a lot more to unpacking this, and perhaps an invitation for anybody to experiment with this practice in their own life. And what is important for me to say is that in my work, the even greater significance of searing moments is more to do with the last 30, 40 years of my life, how I've used it in my adult life in creating, choreographing searing moments. So something would happen, and it would be just a quote-unquote a mundane moment in time, but the in-the-moment intuitive sense that I would bring to it tremendous significance. And I would make more out of it to make it a searing moment because it carried a potential that I didn't want to lose. And how time and again that would occur, not so much by me deciding that I should, I'd feel compelled to, only to fully discover the meaning and the reason sometimes 7 days later, sometimes 7 years later. The core spiritual propulsion of what we are sensing into is actually being alive. Actually being alive in the moment, not treating yourself as a collection of moments that happened in the past, recognizing that the entirety of your life is active hologram, or I don't know what the word is, because it's not just three-dimensional. The multidimensional, it's all active in the moment, and you, a bit like you can on your computer go and open a file, you can go and open a file, and not only will you open the file, it won't be a PDF file, that you can't change. You can actually go into the Word document and rescript the content of that experience. And when you do, not only have you changed the present, you've actually healed the past. And because you have healed and rescripted the past, you have changed the present and enabled a whole new future to reveal itself to you. And I think, and I believe that there is an extraordinary potential, transformative potential for individuals, for groups of people, for nations, because we need to find ways to honor so much of what has happened, the painful and the beautiful, because if we're going to do good in the world going forward, we need to be truthful about the what brought us here. And it's difficult to sense or unlock the potential of goodness and the potential of beauty without bringing the third sister, which is truth. So if goodness, truth, and beauty are part of the unlocking of the green universe, because those three natures, they often reappear when something at a whole new level, at the next new octave, when the epoch needs to be unlocked or rejuvenated or renewed. And I'm proposing that a searing technology is one technique, one practice to access and source those realms of potential.
Well, I feel it. I feel how we can collectively reauthor our story, re-understand the past, not denying the experiences. Although I also can feel that in reauthoring, there may be some metaphysical, some esoteric way in which the past is literally being transformed and the horrific events may actually be transmuted. That's to be discovered. I get intuitively that's true, and one step at a time.
The energetic content can be transmogrified. The print of the actual facts can remain as a studied material that offers value, but in a way disinfected from the recurrence of its chain reactive nature and transmission into future generations. So what you are describing there, that I've tried now to in a clumsy way describe in language, because again, I've never talked about this in quite this way, so I'm searching for the language in the moment, but I do believe we are trying to describe the true alchemical nature of the transformational process that a person can conduct in themselves. And when they do, they transform profound healing on themselves and therefore make transmission into the webs of people that they are connected to, certainly into the circles of their family. So yes, I do believe that that's one way human beings and groups of people can melt and heal karmic prints, where time is no longer a factor, because if you change something today, there is in it a reordering, a reauthoring of what occurred, because you are now, as a result of your process, in a new, different place. So we are sensing into new arts and new sciences, and other people may speak about these realms in other ways, but it's emergent for us. So in this sense, it is new. And yeah, we are here in the Discovery Lab. As we talk about the lab, we are inside the lab discovering how it works.
Well, there's one quality that I can share from my own experience of, let's say, heaven on earth, which is that there's no emotional charge around anything. And I include the happy and the sad. There's joy. There's lots of joy. In fact, yesterday I got really clear that the infinite energy supply that I'm connected to is this ocean of bliss rising. And it's a bliss, but it's not a kind of fleeting happiness or the other polarity of sadness or despair. And so the practice now is, if something even kind of begins to announce itself as potentially having a charge, there's like this loving container, I guess I could say, that is created around it. And then the charge or the proto-charge dissipates immediately and doesn't become an energy of a kind of emotion. But there's something about being able to stay very centered and still, and then the whatever it is, the memories kind of wash through. And then there can be a reinterpretation in a very clean way.
Well, so I'm interested for us to, for a minute, become forensic about that practice that's emerging for you, because that's part of what we are trying to do in the portals of practice, trying to capture new emergent practices. Can you try to describe what is it you do internally? Where in your body or in your system do you feel that? And what do you do? Almost as though you would be giving an instructional brief for somebody to go through that practice that you are trying to describe.
Oh, this is great, because it is totally emergent. And so we're definitely skating to the edge. And many things that have been today have been said for the first time by both of us. So yeah, if a memory comes up of something that I might hitherto have been ashamed of or embarrassed by, certainly I could think of a long list. I feel it, I have to lean forward. I feel it kind of to the left of my heart. In this moment, that's what's coming to me. That's the place in my body. I suspect other people may feel it in other locations. So this is just my example. And then now there's a kind of automatic response of love. Like, it's a form of, I guess you could say, forgiveness as well, and allowing, because I'm not fighting it. I'm just bathing it in love and not pushing it out of my mind, not suppressing the memory, because it will just come back in that case. It's more like, okay, here you are. Let's be with this, but let's be with this in a spacious way. So breathe and feel the feeling, if there's a physical sensation, for instance, and don't buy into the story. Like, my mind doesn't go into the story now. The reauthoring opportunity, which I'm seeing thanks to our conversation, is when the time is right, which might be after a few seconds or a minute, or, I mean, it happens pretty quickly now, but to appreciate the gift of the experience, kind of like I said, the generosity of my parents when they moved on from this world, seeing that as a generous act. And so whatever it might be in my own past that causes me some consternation when it comes up, appreciating that it has some very, very important gift, especially right now, because it's coming up right now. And then not necessarily answering the question, what is the gift? It might come to me spontaneously, but it's fine to leave the question open and just know that there is a gift. Ah, there is a gift. It's like there's this multidimensional key that turns a little bit each time. And if I don't fight it, if I don't resist it, the lock is that much closer to being completely opened. So yeah, each of these energies I see as having neither a negative or positive quality. It's more like, oh, that's the key. Like it or not, that's the key. There's a key in here, maybe more than one, and be grateful.
Yes, beautiful. So may I attempt to narrate back to you the practice and add one or two steps and name them as we go? As part of this is we practically in a discovery lab here.
Yes, please.
Okay, so step one is awareness. We become aware, and the awareness may either appear as somatic awareness, I feel tension or pain somewhere in the body. You point to the area left of the heart, maybe somewhere else, maybe it's something to do with the neck, maybe something to do with the back, maybe somewhere else. So there is either an emergent somatic awareness associated with a thought pattern, or you become first aware to a story running in your head, a repetitive thought, and actually then you discover that you are tied in your chest. So the awareness may appear through somatic presencing, through being a present to your somatic emergent condition and the signal, or through a thought. And so step one is awareness. Step two, I propose we call, I'll give you two names and you will propose which is a better way. Step two is making space or stepping back. I visually, practically see myself stepping back, to see myself from the back, or sometime step above, but step above is a whole other technology. I won't go into it now. Step back and I see the thought and the somatic signal occurring. So first I make a space for that. I don't suppress it. I don't even try to immediately embrace it with love. I seek a space to allow it to be.
Very happy with the language, making space and stepping back in order to make space. That both work for me.
And then I think step three is what you describe as, so you embrace it or transmit to it or breathe into it love, compassion, care, kindness, you melt the fixing with whatever it is that is arising in you that you feel is the updating currency of your life and the purpose you're joined to. And then, so that's awareness, making space, embrace, and reauthoring. And then when you do that, you can take the components of that, the material of that occurrence, and reauthor it to see in it the potential, the teaching developmental potential that it brings you today. I propose we were to coach this to somebody else. We would be talking perhaps through these four steps and staying with each one of those to explore the nature of discovery and interior actuality that arises to facilitate it.
There's something else I want to share, and it relates to your defiance at a young age. This will not be my reality. This will not be my story, related to the mild heart condition. And this would be back in 2008. I can really remember the moment. It was a searing moment. And it's one of those where I made it more searing over time because I recognized the significance and wanted that to remain and weave throughout the rest of my days. So this moment involved me seeing that I had a thought that was repeating and not a particularly constructive thought. And I said, essentially, in that moment, I will not think a thought like this, an unconstructive thought, more than twice. When I notice I've repeated myself, I will stop. And that took root. I would say that something shifted. It's like the rest of my being said, okay, then. And so that has made it possible, has made it easier to step back and make space, because that's the awareness. Ah, I've had an unconstructive thought twice now. Something's going on. The wiser me would say, and it's useful. Let's make space for it.
You unlocked the inner samurai, and it adds in another dimension to the practice we just looked at, which is that sometimes you will heal something with love, embrace it. In other occasions, the silver sword of the samurai will come and will instantly separate something. It's not heated defiance. It's the ferocity of purpose, of what you know you're about, and your refusal to give way to lesser influences inhabiting the ecology that you are. And to live in this day and age, you need to unlock that tool set as well. Very critical, very critical. And we are talking here about practices, Jeff, that next generations of leaders need in their development and how they will facilitate and encourage groups of people that they work with. Because, so this leads me to offer just a very brief starter entry into the green and the blue streams. And as I said, when we talk about the green epoch and the blue epoch, we are talking about a stream of potential, a stream of intelligence, where the colors are not signifiers of a mental model or a map, period. Rather, they are the representation of an intelligence stream that flows through the epoch and has a function and a purpose and its own teleology. And you and I have spoken on a different call about the significance of the transition from tribal consciousness to individuated consciousness. And partly we looked at it at that time in the idea. So I am narrating here a perspective, a theological perspective of evolution, one where the evolutionary process is not merely an ascending from the bottom up, period, but rather one where there is a double helix, where the realms of potential, together with the ascending human realm, engaged in a participatory, collaborative journey. Some may say, I don't get it, and so I will sometime offer, well, think therefore about the collective best of humanity and how it retains that idealized evolving teleology and its permission in terms of where that get unleashed. This is if the framework of thinking that we're actually operating inside an intelligent universe that is caring and loving and compassionate all at the same time, enabling and facilitating our development and evolution. But if you did go there with me for a minute, even as a thought experiment, then consider that there was a time in the ancient world where we were still largely operating inside the tribal entity, the tribal consciousness. And if there is such a thing as a universal plan and the universe needed us to unleash and unlock more of what we humans were seeded with potential, well, then a critical stage in that was the unlock of the individuated permission. And I'm proposing that the function, one of the expressions of the green universe, the fractal of green, is to unlock that potential, to release and liberate human life from being arrested in its tribal configuration, tribal permission, to individuated consciousness. And you can trace that all the time, all the way from the ancient world to the 20th century, and recognize, for example, the work of Jung and why was it that his project centered on individuation and how he saw that to be prerequisite to the sense of the Aquarian age, that we can now further look at in a broader context, which we are sensing into the idea of Homo Universalis, where we are graduating into a self-authored permission in universal life, inside of which the searing moment practice we've just explored is a case in point, is a technology that we are empowered by, such that we can live that generative, creative, in the moment reauthoring our experiences. So that's very nice. That's the green epoch. But now we have a problem, because if we used to be tribes, and if the green permission, and it's not the only purpose and function of green. Green was here to renew, to rejuvenate, to unlock and bring new ideas and new permission. But if we get individuated, we now have a huge big problem, which is, so how will we facilitate coordinated action? How will we become a collective? And that's one of the purposes and the functions of the blue fractal, the blue emergence, and how that stream of intelligence in the epoch plays out is forever reasserting our capacity to become collaborative, to find a way to regulate ourselves, not just individually, but collectively. So law and the legal system is an expression. One side of the blue stream, the sense of institutions and government and city-states and nations and countries, all of those developments, they were permissions given by the blue stream of intelligence. Initially, we gained our unique position as the sapient species, and it's the primacy of our position on the planet, because we were able to coordinate ourselves together as large groups, larger than the Dunbar numbers of 150 or more or less people. So not only tribal arrangements, but larger arrangements of people able to center on a shared sense of purpose and mission. And then you look at that entire 2000 year history and you see two big realization points. One is, most of the world order as we have known it, certainly if you're born in the middle of the 20th century, but really the arc of time of the last 2000 years and certainly the last 400 years, the world, the structure of the world as we have known it, is largely an expression of what I'm proposing, is that blue stream of intelligence. And now we're seeing, over the last two, three, four decades, certainly through the 60s, from the 60s and through the, so over the last 60 years, we increasingly are seeing the breakdown, one cycle after another cycle after another cycle, of the breakdown of that system. We looked yesterday at that moment in time when Fukuyama wrote and published in 1989 the End of History ? Article that created ripples in think tanks in Washington, D.C., and largely the elite circles in the political and business worlds bought to the story that it was the end of history, because the belief at the time and what he communicated was the liberal system, which was a blue system that developed And when I say liberal system, I don't mean the liberal party in the US or in any other country or the democratic. I'm talking about the system, the democratic liberal systems, he said was the end of history, because he was seeing at the time and asserting the argument that fascism was destroyed or was eliminated in the Second World War. And he was predicting a few months before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the implosion of the Soviet Union that the communist system was going to break down. And so that moment, that American moment in time appeared. And for a few years, we lived with the idea that perhaps we entered 100 years of peace and prosperity governed by one power, which was the American power. And we now know that was not true. We now know that was a misreading of history. We now know there were many more cycles that happened in the upswing of the 90s and as the new century began. And now as we are entering, have entered the third decade of century, we see that we are certainly in the way we've experienced the pandemic. There are now many countries around the world looking and saying, well, maybe the Chinese model is more effective than the American model because they handled the response to the pandemic more effectively. So we are in a crisis point in terms of what is the system that would actually win the rest of history. But in the context of the unfolding of the epochal progression, the story we tell is that history didn't end with blue. There were more stages to come. And we left with this cliffhanger without fully unpacking what the next stages are. But if you are a student of the septenary system, you know that indigo and violet follow blue. The important point where I will anchor this is to say we're not looking at a chronological linear story. We're looking at those fractals as they appear. And our conversation started with you deciding to not hold back and say that you felt that we have just gone through some kind of a transition or some kind of a culmination of a transition in which you use the language of heaven on earth, which can perhaps be a language to describe how you are sensing into and exploring the sense of the indigo and the violet permission and what they bring online. That's a long and concise way of bringing and integrating these two dimensions to our conversation.
Thank you, Aviv. Well, I'm happy to leave the question open in terms of what does heaven on earth mean. I do feel there's a resonance with what you're pointing to in terms of indigo and violet. Yeah, something in me feels that it's like a great open space that we can create within. And so this notion of self-authorship and self-authored, autonomous, I'll say awakened individuals coming together to collaborate and co-create at a higher level of effectiveness. Well, that's something that I see the potential for, but I would actually bet on happening in this next period of time. And in terms of the experience, opening to the experience of heaven on earth or some kind of paradise, I mean, it sounds so utopian, it sounds so unattainable, but that's the mind saying, or the mind doubting that we could have a much, much better existence on this planet. And so I'm inviting us to set aside such disbelief and open our hearts, open our whole beings to the possibility there has been a fundamental pattern shift, that a sea change is occurring, that there's an inevitability to it. And in trusting the inevitability, my sense is a huge amount of energy that has gone into creating defensive structures, psychological ego defenses, but also collective defenses at the level of nations, that energy doesn't need to be spent that way. China is a very interesting example because they really haven't spent money on warfare. Sure, they have a big military and increasingly a large navy in the South China Sea and so on. And we'll see where all of that leads. But you know, that seems to me wise, not spending energy in creating and continuing conflict around the world so as to assert power. Well, that energy can be used in very productive ways. And I'm very confident that we will, by degrees, this is a pun, rise to address the challenge of climate change, for instance, that we will have the requisite level of coordination to respond effectively. And it may take a few more years, but I see not a linear curve, but an exponential curve in terms of our growth in this direction. And maybe because it's time, maybe because the previous epoch is complete. And so it's just a necessary feature of history that we're now arising in this way. So I'm open to the various explanations. I do really appreciate yours, and I feel that it is a powerful way of framing these times and an empowering way for leaders.
Yeah.
In charge of large organizations that need to make critical decisions.
Yeah, beautiful. So to add one final layer into the equation we are exploring, into the story we are exploring, is blue did not end in 1990 or in the blue world order that emerged after the Second World War with the Bretton Woods Agreement and the United Nations and so on. And what we actually explored over this weekend is the sense that blue by itself needs an update, because we actually need a new blue. We need a new green. We need a new yellow. Oh, we do need a new red and orange too. So we need the entire septenary to be allowed to find its update through us. And what each of these intelligence streams and waves of potential represent. And so because green is so expansive and far and encompassing in its reach, we just named together collectively, it was a work with contribution of many, many people. Actually, don't think I've conducted that type of a workshop where you get contributions from 200 people. Not everybody spoke to on the Zoom call, but many, many people did. And so we were actually building the technology of many, many people communicating, not just in rooms, but in the forum and the way to do this. But to the specificity we were focusing on was naming many fields that need update inside four zones of the blue. So zone one was to do with personal development. What do I want to become? What do I want to be? And so we named 24 different fields of work, some of which are similar to the practice we just touched on. Working somatically, working with your mind, working with your character, working with your self-regulation, developing greater awareness, and so on. All of which were part of that zone one. Zone one is personal development. Zone two, we looked at collective development. Who do we want to be? Who do we want to become? And that involves family well-being and wellness. And that involves the ethics and the values and the ways of cultivating organizational health and well-being. And the behavioral sciences that go with that and the leadership sciences that go with that. So that was zone two. And we then said, well, blue is also to do with seeking the truth of things. So there is a need for a whole new scientific revival. We need all sorts of sciences, old sciences to be rejuvenated and new sciences to emerge. Because we're now living through time where the idea of truth has been completely thrown in the middle into question mark. So, and logic and language and even the legal system, because the legal system is purely referential on precedence, which is reasoned and all the rest of it, great. But what it actually means is that as a species, we do not trust our capacity to reason in the moment, to be in an emergent reasoning. So therefore, we have a legal system that's based on precedence. I'm not suggesting to throw it away, and the scholars of the law will immediately correct me and say, you're missing the point. The legal system is actually updating in an emergent way as it reasons. I get it. But what I'm saying is, do we have the capacity as a species, as individuals, as groups, to reason into new experience and to work through the very difficult challenges we have in this zone two that I reflected on? So a whole range of sciences, brain science for sure, need to be renewed. And then we looked at the fourth zone in the blue research, and it talked about a need for a new economy, a need for new education, a need for new geopolitical and diplomacy and policy know-how, because the entire system need to be revitalized if we indeed are sensing that humanity at large is going into a new next phase. And if we believe that the next 100 years is about, first of all, making sure we don't blow this place apart, second of all, that we are able to somehow escape any of the cataclysmic civilizational ending potential scenarios. Suppose we are able to avoid and avert all of these, and that's not a given at all. The history would prove the opposite. So if we are able to do so, then partly it's because we're able to emerge as a species in a new way to address the problems we've been looking at from new places and to source and activate new kind of solutions. Somehow, the work that is done by many individuals and many pods of people and many small groups of people all around the world, somehow that needs and wants to emerge over the coming decade to reach greater circles of influence, such that because the people in the place of power, by definition, they hold the old system. That's why they're in power. So for them to let go and to see that there is a different way to hold the system, or actually not hold the system, discover a way to work with the system in a dynamic fashion rather than in a locked way, that is nice dance to describe on a Zoom call. What it actually means in global terms is new leaders emerging to new levels of consciousness. We have signs of them around the world. We've got many more women entering leadership positions at a national level. I'm not excluding men, but it's wonderful to see more women in those positions. And discovering that there is a way perhaps to address local, national, and global challenges in a dynamic fashion, where there may be a way to address all those challenges in an integrated way. And if that is to be unlocked and the operating system of such, you'd say, utopian story I'm telling now can be accessed, then you need individuals who come at that challenge from many directions, from many different set of experiences, with many different skill sets to enable that kind of discovery to emerge. So that's the space we sensed into over the last few days, this 3-day weekend.
Oh, I love it. I love that you've named it too, this wide range of opportunities in the space of our conversations. I know that this is a powerful field for speaking into being, and others will engage with this video, hopefully being activated to go and be the change. I also want to introduce one piece of vocab as we move to closing, just to shift away from this idea of heaven on earth and the utopian, because I do feel the groundedness of everything that you're doing. And so I have been talking about the healed and transformed world. And I have a sense that, although it's more syllables, that's really what I'm talking about. That's what I'm experiencing. That's what I'm inviting others into. Maybe on a future call, we can talk about embodying the transformed world. It's been a major theme recently. And getting there, there's a lot of trauma healing. There's a lot of reconstruction, brand new construction to do as well. So this can be a great time for humanity. And I'm grateful to have partners like you on the journey.
Thank you very much. And I love it that you seeded a further conversation on the healed and transformed world and the arts and science of embodiment and its centrality for the healed and transformed world. To be continued on another discovery here at Portals of Perception. Thank you so very much, Jeff.
Thank you, Aviv. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Portals of Perception. If you're enjoying these dialogues, we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and a review at ratethispodcast.com/portals. Visit portalsofperception.org for exclusive content. Please share this episode with a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.